Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, ground control to Major Tom, or she packed my bags last night pre-flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m., or Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating weightless, calling, calling home. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
I'm Joe McCormick. I think we've already had that third one, haven't we?
We probably have, but yeah. It's still very fitting for this particular episode. So that's why I had to have extras to fill in for the fact that I was already quoting myself again. Next to myself, but anyway.
It sounds like we're talking about space.
We are talking about space.
The final frontier.
It's very cold in space. But yeah, we're going to talk about space and space exploration, and really this whole idea of exploring space using manned missions versus unmanned missions. Like, why should we concentrate on one more than the other? Is one intrinsically better than the other? Is the era of manned space exploration, at least for the time being, over? Is it just beginning? And kind of have a full discussion about the whole idea. So, I guess we should probably start with kind of a historical look at manned and unmanned missions, right?
Well, okay. So y'all know when we first landed on the moon, right?
Yeah, I wasn't born yet, but yes, it was 1969.
Yeah,
with the Apollo missions, yeah.
Now, unless you watch Arrested Development, in which case the first real moon landing was 1971.
Yeah. Or if you're one of those conspiracy theorists generally, right?
Right, if you somehow believe that that the most amazing human achievement arguably was actually faked.
It's a product of Stanley Kubrick and a set in the desert somewhere. Yeah.
Right. Which, by the way, we do not subscribe to that.
Yeah. Well, okay. Turns out that's still wrong either way, depending on how you define the question. We actually put tons of stuff on the moon before any humans got there.
That's where my remote control is, actually. I'm pretty sure. I don't have any direct proof, but I can't find it anywhere here on Earth.
And most of my left socks.
Yeah. Wait, wow, your socks are actually left and right?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, seriously. We actually had something on the moon in the 50s.
The 50s?
In the 50s, yeah. In 1959... the Soviet probe Luna 2 smashed into the moon. It's not quite what you'd call a landing.
More of a crash.
But it took some molecules from Earth and it put them on the surface of the moon.
Right.
And they're still there in one way or another.
Now that's, honestly, I did not, I had known of the Soviet space program and the fact that they had fired stuff to the moon and actually landed things on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
But until we did the research for this, I honestly could not remember the name of the program at all. And the reason why I bring that up is because that plays into what part of our conversation later on. I just think it's an interesting thing is that I'm aware of it, but I wasn't really knowledgeable about it.
Yeah.
Sure. And I think that part of that is that none of us were alive then, you know, and so, you know, perhaps if we had been the geeks that we are in that particular time period, we would remember these things, but.
Maybe, but there are so many of those, and I was just astonished how many things we put on the moon that I didn't even know about
before Apollo 11 set down.
You had this impact in 59.
Right. And the hard landing.
Yeah. The first soft landing was another Soviet spacecraft. It was the same. It was from Luna 9, so the same series, and that was in 1966.
So still years before we managed to land any people.
Oh, but only a couple years. I mean, that's a impressive... a loose definition of a couple.
Sure.
But that's a very short period of time between manned and unmanned.
Well, it's amazing what we didn't know about the moon back then. So when they put down Luna 9 on the moon, one of the important things they found out is, oh, okay, so you can put stuff on the moon and it won't sink.
Right.
Can you imagine, think about this, you're a NASA scientist planning a manned mission to the moon. We're going to put some astronauts on there. But one option in your mind is that the moon is completely covered in dry quicksand.
Right.
And that when you set foot on it, you would sink into the moon.
Right.
Into the moon.
That perhaps it was just so powdery that you would end up so deeply entrenched in it that mm-hmm. there would be no way to get back out again.
Yeah, but so the Luna 9, they learned that, oh, okay, no, you won't sink. You know, it's safe for human landing. The Surveyor 1 was the first U.S. spacecraft to land on the moon. That was a few months after the Luna 9, and then we had a bunch of other impacts and landers before we ever got to the Apollo 8, which orbited the moon, and then 11, which finally set down.
Right.
And so it took us this long to get to the human landing, but the human landing is what everybody remembers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you talk to people about moon landings, then they naturally tend to think of the Apollo missions, specifically Apollo 11, although six missions did ultimately land on the moon. I think 12 astronauts were able to walk on the surface of the moon. And so, you know, that's and one of those missions was supposed to go there, but didn't quite manage
that.
Oh,
yeah. Right, well, we'll talk about that later. But so this kind of puts something in perspective. We haven't been back to the moon with human beings since the 70s.
Right. And we've seriously cut back on just manned missions into space in general with,
Haven't been anywhere else either.
Well, I'm talking about being like just even going into orbit. The space shuttle program's been shelved. It's actually, been scrapped at this point. It's retired. It's done. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a space shuttle mission anymore.
Not governmentally speaking anyway.
Yeah. We have
privately.
Even then it's not space shuttle, but yeah, it's the Dragon space program, things like that, over at SpaceX. And then a few other, countries, of course, still have space programs that are sending people to and from the International Space Station. But, you know, I think when we had the first moon landing and we had the first experience of seeing people walking on the surface of the moon, the natural progression there was to think, wow, this is the beginning.
Yeah, here we go.
Yeah, we're going to go out there and we are going to explore the solar system and beyond, and people are going to play a big part in that. And as it turns out, a lot of that hasn't happened. I mean, we have explored the solar system quite a bit, but we've done so with these unmanned missions. And we kind of wanted to talk a little bit about why that is. Why have we gone down this route of unmanned versus manned?
So I think first we should just give a real brief overview of what these unmanned missions look like, and then what kind of advantages they provide over manned missions, or what are the disadvantages of manned missions?
Sure.
So a lot of what we're talking about is space probes, or planetary orbiter probes.
Right, and occasional rovers.
Yeah, and rovers. And so the most common is we'll send out a probe that's like it orbits other planetary bodies and it takes data readings of all different kinds, sometimes photographs.
Right.
You've got the deep space probes like Voyager, and they're just going.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, these are ones, the Voyager probes in particular were designed to do surveys of the outer planets in our solar system. And then once they were done with that, they were to continue on into the furthest reaches of our solar system.
And gravitationally ricocheted off of Jupiter?
Yeah,
Jupiter?
It was.
Am I crazy?
It all depends on which Voyager you're talking about.
Oh,
because
okay.
one of them just visited essentially, like Saturn and Jupiter, and the other one went further out all the way to Neptune, and then headed off into interstellar space or toward interstellar space. We should say that it's one of those milestones that has constantly shifted the idea of leaving the solar system.
Yeah.
Right. It seems like about every 3 months, NASA goes like, oh, it's leaving the kind of thing that we thought was the edge of the solar system, but we're finding out that it's bigger than we thought.
I kind of think of that as like trying to leave Atlanta. The further out you go, the bigger Atlanta becomes. So, for example, if you live within Atlanta, you tend to think Atlanta is the city, like the city of Atlanta.
The city has an extremely high escape velocity.
Right. You get to the perimeter and then you're thinking, all right, well, now, because the perimeter is actually bigger than the city, right? So, you get to the perimeter and then other people who are outside the perimeter are saying, no, you're still in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
You get a little further out of there and people who are like in Athens are saying, no, you're still in Atlanta. Even if you say you're in Stone Mountain, you're still in Atlanta. I know that this has lost everybody else who doesn't live in the Metro Atlanta neighborhood, but hey, it's true. It's one of those things where the solar system gets bigger the further out we go, and nope, you're not done yet.
So you've got the space probes.
Yes.
You've got a few landers, like the Venera landers that landed on Venus.
Right.
Those were Soviet craft that, if you ever see the pictures these things take, if you haven't seen and Googled the photographs taken by the Venera lander, they're just kind of some rocks, but it's still haunting.
Yeah.
This eerie yellow mist over this scary looking gravel. I don't know. Something about it haunts
me. One young girl wearing a night shift and her hair down over her face. Is she?
Yeah, basically.
I might be looking at the wrong pictures.
But a lot of these landers don't make it back. We've had a Japanese space agency had to put a lander on an asteroid and then got that to return to Earth, but not a whole lot of landers. We've had some rovers, like rovers on the moon and on Mars.
Right.
The Mars rovers, we've had a bunch of those. Yeah. Right. The most recent
Spirit,
ones.
Spirit, Opportunity, the Curiosity.
Yeah. Viking? Was Viking one?
Viking was, I thought that was a probe.
Might have been. I'm sorry if I got that mixed up.
Viking landed, but it wasn't a rover. It landed on Mars and it gave us our first color images of Mars, the Viking one. But I don't remember it being mobile.
Okay. I think that's right. Yeah, and the most recent, obviously, is Curiosity. One thing, a lot of these, and of course, we mentioned orbiters, but there have been more recent orbiters of different planets. We've seen, like, Cassini doing its cool work in Saturn, and the Grail probes doing gravity research on the moon.
Right.
One thing all of these unmanned missions seem to have in common is that they're suicide missions, you know.
Like there's
sort of a planned end. It's just like, well, because we've got all these dead rovers on Mars, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some are still going, some aren't.
Some are destined to die on Mars.
Well,
yeah.
They're all destined to die pretty much.
Unless we get our butts over there real quick and
find a way of picking them up and bringing them back.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, we've learned a lot of cool stuff from these unmanned probes, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we learn lots of basic information about the environments that we send them to. Mm-hmm. For instance, we can learn things like the chemical composition of the soil or the regolith on these surfaces, whether it's the moon or Mars or whatever. We can get images back. We can take samples of atmosphere, if there is one, and learn what makes up the atmosphere of that planet or moon or whatever. We can get a lot of information, things like whether or not the planet has a magnetosphere or all this other kind of stuff that is important for us to know, particularly if we want to do further scientific endeavors that involve this planetary body. And I would imagine for all of these, we want to do that.
Mm-hmm. And even just figuring out how our universe works. You know?
Yeah.
Learning stuff is cool.
And the history of our solar system and the history of our planet and our place in the universe. I mean, all of these things play a role in why we would do this. And to your point about these suicide missions, I think that's one of the big reasons why unmanned missions have taken such precedence, because it means that we can send stuff that
We don't have to get back.
We don't have to get it back. So that takes care of a huge engineering problem, right? I mean, coming up with an engineering solution to not only get a spacecraft out to another body in space, but then back again is an enormous challenge. And it is amazing to me that we have managed to do that so many times. But it definitely makes missions, I hesitate to use the word easier, but less complex if you don't have to worry about getting them back home again.
We can go ahead and say easier. I think that.
Yeah, no, it is easier.
I think that's fair.
It's an annoying thing about humans is they usually want to come home.
Yeah.
Well, and also that they want to breathe air and eat food.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So, well, that takes us to where we're going next, I guess.
The whole idea about the benefits versus the costs and risks of manned and unmanned flight.
So what's wrong with manned missions?
Well, let's talk about cost a bit.
Okay, all right. So about $25 billion was spent on the Apollo program in the 1960s. In today's money, that's about $185 billion.
Okay.
Which is a few dollars.
Yeah, it's a lot. $185 billion.
It's more than two.
It's more than what I make in an average year.
And a lot of that went to the human spaceflight element of the mission. I think about $20 billion.
Out of the 25.
Out of the 25.
Wow. So essentially, that money
like four fifths.
Yeah. So that's covering everything from the systems on board the spacecraft to the personnel both in the spacecraft and on the ground that are in charge of all the things that are keeping the astronauts alive. I mean, you think about it, it's not a surprise that so much money would need to go in to the safety and health of astronauts. As it turns out, space is not a very forgiving environment.
Space wants to kill you.
Yeah. So, all right, so $25 billion, or like you said, about $185 billion in today's money. So how does that compare against an unmanned mission?
Oh, well, the Mars Curiosity Space Lab project, as of right now, sits at about $2.5 billion.
Significantly less.
Yeah.
Now,
wow.
We should also point out that other things to take into consideration involve the proximity of the moon as compared to the proximity of Mars. Turns out moon is a bit closer.
Right.
By like millions and millions of miles. But
a bunch of the cost, yeah, is going to be in fuel.
Right.
And just, yeah, getting it all the way out there and making sure that your instrumentation is powerful enough to transmit.
It's interesting
distance.
Though, because you sit there and you think about it, and you think, well, if it costs $185 billion to run the Apollo program, which, granted, is greater than just the moon landing.
Sure. And it's also a bunch of missions.
Right.
the Curiosity rover is
one mission.
One
right.
basic mission.
Apollo was 17 missions.
Right.
And only six of those landed on the moon and came back.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Curiosity rover was one mission out to Mars. But if you just extrapolate, if you sit there and think, well, if it costs us $2.5 billion to send essentially a remote-controlled car onto the surface of Mars and move it around some, then how expensive would it have been to have had a Mars landing program where we're putting in the same care and development in life support systems as well as everything else just to get people there and back? And it's a huge expense. And while we don't want to suggest that scientific discovery should all boil down to how much money does it cost, that is a factor you have to take into consideration.
It's a practical factor.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I would love it if we didn't have to worry about money when it comes to science. I would love it if that were just not something we had to think about at all. But the reality is, you do.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your feelings about allotting money to science, you have to accept that these projects have a budget.
Yeah.
And whatever that budget is, you need to deal with it.
Yep.
And so we've got to do the best we can with the money that we can get.
Mm-hmm. In further contrast, the Voyager program, and the numbers here get a little bit squiggly because Voyager was launched a little while ago and in inflation rates and differences. I mean, and we're still putting money into that project into building satellite arrays to better detect the signals from these guys.
Right. This is the project where we have these probes that are going further and further away. So it means that we have to keep building more sensitive radar technology or radio technology, I should say, like radio antennas. To pick up the signals that these things are sending back, because they're getting weaker and weaker over time because they're going further and further away from us.
Right. But overall, that's cost about $1 billion.
Yeah. So again, the cost of unmanned missions, I think that plays a big part in why there's been such a concentration in them. It's the idea that we can do a lot more research for less money. And then there are the other factors.
Well, yeah, a lot of that cost comes from a lot of the cost of the manned mission, the mm-hmm. reason that costs more is because you're having to spend huge amounts of money on training and safety.
Right.
To keep the astronauts alive.
Yeah. Like we said, space is not a very forgiving environment at all. It's very dangerous.
Let's just talk about all the ways space wants to kill you.
Okay. There's the lack of air.
Yeah. So there's a lack of air. The most common ones you'd think about are lack of air, maybe lack of gravity, coldness. So we can talk about those. Lack of air, that's pretty obvious. You have to take oxygen tanks, but that's not always so easy because, of course, like oxygen is explosive, and as we saw in the Apollo 13, wasn't it one of their oxygen tanks that had the major malfunction?
Yeah. And then there was the buildup of carbon dioxide within the capsule itself.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more later. But so you've got that problem. You've got, of course, it's freezing in space.
Yeah,
so
you've got the vacuum of space, which mm-hmm. that'll kill you. I mean, even if we talk about the lack of air, but
explosive decompression. Of course.
Right. Lack of air goes beyond. And lack of oxygen, obviously. We're talking about, like, there are not really that many molecules out there in the first place.
You have to – having a pressurized spacecraft in a near vacuum out in space, it's like having a balloon. You know, it's just – it's waiting to pop.
Yeah, it's – yeah. And so if you were to have a hull breach, you know, people talk about – stuff getting sucked out of the spacecraft. That's not really what's happening. It's getting blown out. As Data on Star Trek Next Generation would one day correct Captain Picard. Yeah, I saw that episode not that long ago. But anyway, so there's the vacuum of space, there's the lack of oxygen. Like you said, microgravity.
Microgravity,
or,
yeah.
Or as I like to call it, zero G, because I like to see Joe go crazy.
Hey, so this is a little nerd happiness moment we're going to share with you. So if you're talking with your friend who works for NASA, and you're talking about being in space, you don't want to say zero gravity, because you're not really at zero gravity in space. You're at what we would call microgravity. It's
right.
Gravity so small that it might be almost
negligible.
Unnoticeable or even totally negligible.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's why I
call
it zero.
But it's not totally zero.
Oh,
so if you're
right.
At zero G, one of the problems.
Gravity, so you're never okay. So you're in zero gravity.
So you're in zero gravity.
You'd be floating in any case.
Yeah, you are effectively weightless, if not completely weightless.
So, Jonathan, what does that do to your body?
It does a lot of things. First of all, it can.
Are they nice things?
They are not. Well, I mean, you can do flippy flips.
That's nice.
And roly rolls, and those are nice. That's fun. If you don't have a strong stomach, you might also do some barfy barfs.
So people who are new to microgravity environments experience space sickness. Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got some organs in your ear, these little microorgans that are essentially like a three-axis accelerometer. It's essentially the same sort of thing as you would find in a three-axis accelerometer device. It's what tells your body how it's oriented in comparison to the ground. And then you have your visual input that you come in to play. And if the visual input and the input you're getting from those little microorgans are at odds, you start to feel a bit dizzy, disoriented, sometimes nauseated.
Furthermore, a lot of those microorgans involve fluid, and if the fluid is floating, then your ear just does not know how to read that data. It's like, well, screw it.
Yeah, but something is happening what ought not to happen.
Yeah.
And so, you can definitely feel disoriented and nauseated, but that's small potatoes compared
tip
to the real
iceberg.
Problems. Yeah, so let's talk about prolonged exposure to microgravity. All right. So if prolonged exposure could mean everything from muscle loss, just because your muscles aren't having to work against gravity. So you are starting to lose muscle mass that way.
People on the ISS, they spend a lot of time exercising just to try to maintain muscle density. But even then, I think despite, however long they spend on the treadmill every day, they still have muscle density loss.
Yeah, they have to go through a lot of physical therapy when they get back to Earth.
Yeah, and then there's bone density loss, and that's really serious.
Yeah.
Muscle you can rebuild. Bone you cannot. So you start to lose bone. That's a serious problem. And prolonged exposure to microgravity environments does result in bone loss. So that means that you could suffer some pretty serious problems when you get back to Earth. Things like, your bones may not be as sturdy as they used to be, and you may experience joint issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
Exposure to microgravity, I think, can affect your digestive tract too, can it?
It can. Anything
and
that involves...
Not just making you sick, but affect your gut flora, the bacteria.
That, and not only that, but anything that involves fluid, and bodies are nothing if sacks of fluid, can really get affected too.
If not sacks of fluid, I think you meant.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
They are sacks of fluid, in other words. ignore my circuitous speaking, which confuses even myself. At any rate, the fluids get redistributed away from the extremities, which is not the way they normally are. So this causes some problems. Now, initially, the problems involve, for those of us who are vain, a bit of a puffiness around the face, for example. And so people might look a little more flushed and a bit, like a little swollen around the face. And they think, oh, well, that's not attractive. Well, it's worse than that, because you can actually develop prolonged issues like cardiovascular issues due to these redistributed fluids, and blood pressure problems. When you come back down to Earth, you can have issues with your blood pressure, and that can cause more issues down the line. So there are a lot of problems just by being in an environment that's got microgravity for a long time.
Speaking of body fluidics, it affects the shape of the eye, doesn't it?
Yeah, and then you can see things that are invisible to the naked eye, or at least that's the That's the reported reaction. So
kind of creepy.
Is this like an Event Horizon? Because that turned out poorly.
No, it's like cosmic.
We won't need eyes to see where we are going.
It's like things that are outside the visible spectrum for most of us, but apparently because of the way the eye can be reshaped in microgravity, you can start to see things that normally you would not be able to notice. That, though, all seems... Most of the reports seem anecdotal in nature. It's kind of hard. I haven't read too many, like, serious scientific papers on it, so I hesitate to go into it here.
I like the idea that astronauts are just punking us on some of this.
It could be. It could be like, let's tell them you can see the Great Wall of China. Let's tell them that.
Okay,
and
so.
And it gets listed on Trivial Pursuit, which is wrong.
Anyway. I think we need to get to the big one. I think the biggest, the most dangerous effect of prolonged space travel.
Radiation.
Yeah, so you've got all types of radiation.
A lot of lay people might not think about this as much as the lack of oxygen and stuff. But yeah, being in space, you're exposed to radiation from two sources, right?
There's the sun, and then there's everything.
Yeah, there's the entire
the
universe.
Cosmos, yeah. Cosmic radiation, which really, that tends to be high-speed, low-mass particles.
Rays.
Yeah.
Cosmic rays.
And then you have solar radiation, which can involve everything from what we're familiar with, like ultraviolet radiation, things like that. Mm-hmm. Stuff that is also harmful to us if we absorb too much of it over any length of time.
We're protected on Earth by the atmosphere and by the magnetosphere. The Earth is surrounded by gases that absorb some of this radiation, and it also puts out a magnetic field that repels it.
Yeah, some stuff like anything that's a charged ion can get repelled by our magnetosphere. Anything that is not a charged ion but is a particle that's traveling very quickly, once it hits our atmosphere, it slows down, and that both of these things protect us. Now, if you are in orbit, so for example, if you're on the International Space Station, you still have the benefit of the magnetosphere because that extends out pretty far from the Earth. It's not like, you know, as soon as you get up above, you know, 40,000 feet, you suddenly don't have it. But the fact that the atmosphere isn't there to protect you is a concern, which is why they have to build in certain types of shielding, particularly if there is something that they know, like an event has happened, and they have to essentially move away from areas that are more vulnerable to such a thing. So, for example, a coronal mass ejection, a CME from the sun, might mean that they need to relocate for a couple of hours so that they can ride it out while these particles that are traveling at incredible speeds move through the area so that they don't get affected by it. Now, one of the things that can happen if you do encounter a lot of this radiation, assuming that the radiation levels aren't super high, if they are super high, you could suffer radiation sickness and radiation poisoning immediately and start seeing some really serious symptoms develop upon contact. But if they are lower levels, then that's still a problem because it could mean an increase in your chance of developing diseases like cancer. So, this is not a trivial problem. This is something that has had to have been in consideration for every manned space flight. The idea that even if it's a short, relatively short jaunt out and back, you have to think about this stuff and think, well, how do we minimize this effect on the astronauts so that they don't end up coming back sick?
So it gets even worse if you leave the ISS. I've got some facts here. This is from a National Geographic article where they interviewed a scientist named Kerry Zeitlin, and he said that basically an astronaut, say, flying to Mars, going interplanetary space, would get three times the amount of radiation somebody gets on the ISS.
Right.
And during the trip, that would amount to what he used was it would be like getting a whole body CT scan every 5 or 6 days the entire trip.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And we'll go into more detail about the problems of getting to Mars in a future episode, because we've got some more information about that gets, you know, it's sobering stuff. Now, it doesn't mean that we should shy away from it necessarily, but these are some of the risks. And there are other ones too, beyond just these space risks. There's also always the risk of something going wrong, either during launch or landing or reentry to Earth. There are a lot of these risks as well that, you know, we do our best to minimize by doing all our safety checks. But, I mean, even the Apollo program had some pretty famous failures that that resulted in the loss of human life. And then, of course, there was Apollo 13, where we were against all odds, able to rescue, or the astronauts themselves were able to address the situation so that no one died.
Right, right. And you could argue that the capacity of human people to fix what problems go wrong is one of the benefits of manned missions, because, you know, robots don't have the thing that they can, people are a little bit quicker on their feet.
Yeah.
On their brains.
That's one of those things that we can definitely look at as how a manned mission can be superior to an unmanned mission, and the idea of being able to respond to changing situations and adapt to them or address them in some other way.
Also, diapers have never been the same since we sent manned missions out into space.
Oh, you're talking about sort of the Earth-based practical benefits, like the inventions we get.
Yeah, there are a crazy number of inventions.
One might say a crap ton.
Oh dear. That we've gotten out of the NASA program. I need to recover from that entire phrase for a second. No, one of them is in fact diapers. NASA developed the maximum absorbency garment during the space program, which space diapers.
It just makes the whole thing that much more glamorous, doesn't it?
These have terrific healthcare industry uses, and
sure.
are also used by race car drivers and skiers, other professional athletes.
Wow!
During
suddenly being a podcaster seems way more glamorous than it did before. Also, I kind of want some of those now.
Important reflective coatings. Just going to move on.
That's probably best for everybody.
When Skylab was set in position back in 1973, one of the solar panels famously fell off during launch, and a company called National Metalizing helped NASA put together this thin plastic material coated in vaporized aluminum to send up to replace it, and it can deflect or conserve radiant energy depending on what's needed at the time. And this is used to protect people and also manatees from hypothermia.
Wow.
People and manatees. Well, it's manatees can suffer from hypothermia at like 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
The huge manatee.
It's important. Bulletproof materials. During the Mars Pathfinder and Rover landings, Warwick Mills developed a layered coated liquid crystal polyester fiber that can withstand punctures from needles, knives, and bullets. It's currently used for military and police protective gear.
So wait, that was developed through which program?
Mars Pathfinder.
Wow. So
it was for the for cushioning the landing.
Oh, okay. I was thinking there were muggers in space.
There are.
Oh,
other ways that space is trying to kill you.
Right.
Dust busters. Engineers at Black and Decker developed a cordless self-contained power drill during the Apollo moon landings that ended up leading to the dust buster.
Yeah, I think I've read of that before. The power tools in general, basically. Right.
A lot of these benefits, you know, whether it's a manned or unmanned mission, are due to, you know, space exploration. Things that you wouldn't necessarily associate with space, you know, have directly benefited us in many ways that you might be unaware of. And the neat thing to me is that we get these, whether it's unmanned or manned missions, but when it's a manned mission, because of the nature of having to take even more things into consideration, it has pushed entire industries forward. I mean, for instance, transistors, those were pretty young when the Apollo program started. I mean, transistors had not been around for very long, but the Apollo program was the number one destination for transistors that were being produced at that time. Like, NASA was the number one customer for transistors for years because of the Apollo program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that meant that it gave other companies this incentive to continue to improve their manufacturing processes and development processes, so that entire industry grew quite a bit in those years, which benefited everybody further down the line. You go another decade, and then that's when the rise of the personal computer happened. That would not have been possible, or at least it wouldn't have happened at that time, without the space industry.
Yeah, I want to pick up on another benefit you mentioned a minute ago, actually, Lauren, which was the sort of human adaptability factor.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is kind of crucial to the long-term future of space exploration, and this also connects to something we said earlier, that most of these probes are suicide missions.
Right.
You know, we put a rover on Mars and it goes until it can't go anymore, and then that's just a planned obsolescence. It's, you know, at some point we know it's just not going to work.
Right. And if we're lucky, it will work beyond what the parameters were for the mission, but eventually it will stop working.
Yeah. But one thing that occurred to me is that wouldn't necessarily have to be the case if we get to a point where, well, okay, we're better at protecting humans at space, we're smarter, we know how to do it, and it's cheaper, if we could have humans to provide for contingencies, basically. Mm-hmm. But that's where the real human strength lies, is that a human can deal with a problem that was not foreseen in a right. way that machines can't, really.
Yeah.
So imagine if we're exploring Mars and you have a bunch of rovers going around on the surface, but you also have a human technician. Well, if a rover breaks, if there's something wrong with its drivetrain, the human can go and fix that. Or if the rover gets stuck, say, you know.
Right. Well, if there's a dust storm and the rover is all right. Like, the rover manages the... But despite the dust storm, the instrumentation is fine, the rover's fine. Mm-hmm. But as a result, it is now lodged because of, you know, a drift of sand is stuck at where it was. You know, we didn't plan for that because there was no sand there when the rover started moving there. Things like that.
Or just imagine, even outside of maintenance, simple piloting. I mean, there might be a lot of situations where it would be much more beneficial to have somebody nearby controlling a rover.
Right, as opposed to, you know, several million miles away.
Oh, yeah. Right, because as we've talked about before, that, you know, pesky, light speed mm-hmm. limit.
Right.
Yeah, the transmission time might actually mean the death of a mission. If you've got, say, a probe exploring Europa and it encounters some kind of atmospheric variable, something that threatens it, or something that needs to be responded to in real time, if it takes an hour for the signal to get to mission control and then it's operators on Earth to send some direction back to it, that might be too late. Like, right. Think about all these sort of time-bound contingencies that have popped up in previous missions and took humans to deal with. You could think about Apollo 13.
Right.
So they had one of their many problems was, we've got a CO2 buildup in the capsule. And the only CO2 scrubbers we have don't fit the little slot they need to go in.
Right.
So what they had to do was have engineers on the ground instruct the astronauts on how to basically invent a portal to fit the ill-fitting scrubber.
Yeah, they had to jerry-rig
a
new type of connection there.
And so that was nearby, but you can't imagine a machine being able to invent like that.
Right,
And so if that had been, say, something other than... You know, now, it's worth observing that was life support, which wouldn't have been necessary without a human.
Right.
But it could have affected any number of necessary missions.
It could have affected, like, a navigation system
or
some sensor that would... indicate that thrusters were supposed to fire at a very specific moment and they didn't, that kind of stuff.
Another one was Gemini 8.
Yeah, so or Gemini.
Gemini, according to pilot Neil Armstrong, who, by all accounts, sort of saved the mission by some quick thinking. That was supposed to be a sort of experimental mission where they were going to practice docking procedures
right.
in orbit. But they get up there and they had a malfunction where one of their thrusters started firing and wouldn't stop firing, and it sent the ship they were in into an uncontrolled roll.
Mm.
So it was rolling in three directions. And basically, the human crew had to make really fast decisions and use smart piloting to get out of that situation and to land back safely on Earth. And they survived.
Yeah.
But it was, a lot of people would say it was basically because they had a human crew there that was smart, that knew what they were doing.
And was able to respond in real time.
Yeah. And so it's just hard to imagine that a machine would be able to have a planned, programmed response to a contingency that's unpredictable.
Right. Until we get to a point where we have artificial intelligence that can not only detect stimuli or detect specific scenarios and then respond to them, but also anticipate and even improvise at that time. Until we get to that point, then it's pretty clear that humans are going to be better at those kind of situations than machines are.
Yeah, another thing that I think human adaptability really helps is changing research goals. Think about this. I mean, the Curiosity rover is amazing for science.
Yes.
It's taught us a lot of really cool stuff. But it has set mission parameters and stuff it can do. And if you suddenly discovered something, if you wanted to change the mission, that'd be hard to do.
Yeah, because if you discovered that when you landed on Mars that you just sank right into it, then, for example, then, you know, the rover couldn't have done anything about that. Of course, we knew when we launched it that it wouldn't do that.
But say it just wanted to do some kind of sampling or any kind of experiment that wasn't planned for
the original mission parameters.
It wouldn't be able to do that because it wouldn't have the right hardware. It wouldn't have the, you know, it just wasn't programmed.
Yeah.
But a human astronaut, I mean, essentially they could be able to do anything.
Yeah. Anything as long as they had
as long as they got
capable.
The materials. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then that kind of leads us on to another big benefit of manned missions, which is that, you know, you can't really discount the fact that it's an inspiring thing to have, like to have someone who goes out into space and explores truly what we call the final frontier. That's a big thing, and you know it really is an inspiring thing. The world changed when people walked on the moon. The world changed the first time that a Soviet astronaut orbited the Earth. I mean, it's
we consider these people heroes.
Right.
Well,
say orbited the Earth, but went into Earth orbit. But yes.
Right. Think back to what I said at the beginning. Remember all those landers that we put on the moon that we couldn't remember the names of?
Yeah.
I mean, that was all before Apollo 11.
But Apollo 11 is
that's
Apollo
the
11.
One. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you could argue that it's all marketing or something like that, because you know of course a human face and that hero element is something inspiring that these programs that are looking for funding kind of want to latch onto, but at the same time they are, I mean, these are our stories. I mean if you look at something like you know any of the space exploration stories that we have from the past 100 years, and
even some of the more famous rovers, like, you know, we saw with the rise of social media, giving rovers a voice on social media.
Yeah, having the Curiosity rover giving them a Twitter account.
Right. And even before Curiosity, we had rovers that had their own Twitter accounts, and we kind of anthropomorphized these roving robots.
Wally came out. And
yeah, and that helped too. But I remember getting a little weepy when getting messages about how a rover's battery was dying and essentially its job was done, and people were all like, hey, good job. And I mean, like, why am I feeling emotional about
a robot?
Something that cannot feel. It actually isn't. I mean, it's essentially as if I had really did chuck my remote control onto the moon. I might be frustrated that I can't change my channel, but I'm not really sad about the remote control. But it is this thing where we have identified with something that is doing a mission for science, for the good of mankind, for us to learn more about how our universe works. And when it's a person doing that, I mean, the reason why we felt that way about the robot is because they gave the robot a human voice.
Right.
Right? I mean, otherwise we just would have been like, wow, that was a really cool device and I'm glad we did it. But you wouldn't have an emotional connection necessarily.
But you put this whole, like, number five is alive kind of concept next to it. And
that's a powerful story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
I think at the bottom line, a rover can do amazing research, but a human being is an adventure.
Yes. And there's something about adventure that runs deep within the human psyche. There's this desire for adventure, need for adventure for a lot of us. I mean,
wanderlust.
Yeah. The itchy feet syndrome, the idea that, you know, you are exploring and learning, and it's something that goes really, really to the core of being human. It's kind of, you know, it's hard to put it into words because it's just one of those experiences that we kind of all feel, but, you know, it's just part of who we are.
So how do we reconcile this? We know that for now, unmanned missions seem like the much better deal. Like, we can learn so much from them. They're really useful, and they cost so much less, and there's less risk to human life. But the manned missions we've talked about have all these great advantages. How does this balance out?
Well, I think you have to have both. I mean, I think unmanned missions are important so that we can gain as much information about our potential destinations as possible, so that we can prepare for when we actually do go there. But I think that there are a lot of things that you can only do if humans are directly involved. In fact, one of the things NASA has said about the Mars missions is that we've pretty much done everything we can do on Mars without getting people? Our hands on Martian stuff. So right now, the proposed mission, next mission to Mars, is not a manned mission from NASA. This is specifically NASA's approach, but rather to send a series of robots that will gather material from Mars and then bring it back to Earth. And actually, one robot gathers it, another robot retrieves the canister and goes into Martian orbit, and a third one goes into Martian orbit and retrieves the canister from the second robot and then brings it back here.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's a three-robot mission. It's actually the guy from NASA who was explaining it to me was he was thrilled at how my jaw just kept hitting the floor over and over, and because I was thinking what an amazing achievement it was to land the Curiosity rover onto the surface of Mars the way that it happened. It was just such a phenomenal feat of engineering and science that I was speechless when it worked. I could not believe it. I had been hoping and hoping, but when it happened, I was just like, I cannot believe we humans have come up with a way of doing this. And now we're talking about taking the complexity of that mission and essentially, I mean, I could say tripling it, but that really doesn't even bring it into...
That's a crazy underestimation. Yeah.
It's just crazy that what would be necessary for this to work. But we've already done the crazy, so why stop there? Now, that even then we're talking about bringing stuff back, not going there yet. But I think that it is really important that we continue to have the human element in exploration. And not only is it important, it's kind of unavoidable because it is who we are. You know, I mean... To think about the explorers back in the early days, hundreds and thousands of years ago, people who risked their lives to find out what is on the other side of these mountains, you know, that's something that is kind of just intrinsic in us. So while it might be really difficult, I think it's impossible for us not to go out there.
Sure. And I think that dream is going to drive a lot of the rest of the program.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. It's not can we do it, it's can we not do it.
Yeah, how can we not do it? I mean, how could we deny that part of ourselves? And I have I grabbed a collection of sort of interesting quotes about space and astronomy and space exploration, and I just thought I'd share a few of these with you. Some of them are pretty amusing, and one of them at least could be apocryphal, but I will let you know which one that is. So the first one I have, really just kind of to set the scene. This one comes to us all the way from 342 BC. This is Plato, who said, "Astronomy compels the soul to look upward and leads us from this world to another." Which really, that goes right to the heart of what I was saying, this idea of exploration. Now, that was just intellectual exploration at that point. Of course, there was no way that Plato was ever going to get off the surface of the Earth. But I think it really does speak to that desire. Then there's Ray Bradbury, who said in July 1969, "This is the result of 6 billion years of evolution. Tonight we have given the lie to gravity. We have reached for the stars." And, you know, it's this sense of wonder at the achievement of landing people on the moon. And then I love this quote because I love watching the footage of the moon landing and the news reporting that was going around with it, because it just shows how phenomenal that moment was. So when the Eagle landed on the moon, I was speechless and overwhelmed like most of the world. Couldn't say a word. I think all I said was, "Wow, geez, not exactly immortal." Well, I was nothing if not human. That was Walter Cronkite, who, you know, I mean, he was like...
He was the voice of a generation.
He was the voice of the news. And yeah, he really was. And then, like, if you watch the moon landing, you see him break down. Mm-hmm. And, like, just he's so overwhelmed. I mean, that's a phenomenal thing. And then Arthur C. Clarke, famous science fiction author, said, "The moon is the first milestone on the road to the stars." Which, you know, I think we'll have more to say about that in our next episode, because we're thinking about a particular exploration type episode for Friday's show. And then a man, this is the apocryphal quote, possibly apocryphal quote. "A man is the best computer available to place in a spacecraft. It is also the only one that can be mass produced with unskilled labor." That quote is attributed, and again, could be apocryphal, to Wernher von Braun,
wow,
famed rocket scientist.
Oh, that's brilliant.
David R. Scott, who was the commander of the Apollo 15 mission, had a couple of really good ones. One of them is, "For when I look at the moon, I do not see a hostile, empty world. I see the radiant body where man has taken his first steps into a frontier that will never end." And then his other one is, "As I stand out here in the wonders of the unknown at Hadley, I sort of realize there's a fundamental truth to our nature. Man must explore. And this is exploration at its greatest." This one might be my favorite one. It's the penultimate quote in my list, so I do have one more. But it's, "Whoopee! Man, that may have been a small one for Neil, but it's a long one for me." That was Charles Conrad Jr., who was commander of the Apollo 12 and the shortest astronaut in the Apollo program. Reportedly, he made that quote because he had gotten into a discussion with a friend of his who had said that the words of astronauts when they set down on the moon must have been dictated by the United States government, and that, in fact, Big Brother was making sure that they said exactly what was on script. And he said, "I'll say something that will prove you wrong." And that's what he came up with. And he said, "The only thing I regret is he never made good on the bet." And then here's my final quote. "Bob, this is Gene, and I'm on the surface, and as I take man's last step from the surface back home for some time to come, but we believe not too long into the future, I'd like to just say what I believe history will record, that America's challenge of today has forged man's destiny of tomorrow, and as we leave the moon at Taurus Littro, we leave as we came, and, God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind. Godspeed the crew of Apollo 17. So that's Gene Cernan, who was the final person to walk on the surface of the moon, December 14th, 1972.
So far.
So far. Yeah. We hope that that will not be too far into the future when someone else can make history yet again and say the next first words on the moon. So, this is something that I really find very inspirational myself. I definitely love the whole space exploration theme. We have covered that so many times in Forward Thinking, I think it's pretty obvious, but this kind of gets to the heart of why I think it's really incredible stuff. So guys, if you have any comments about space exploration or any thoughts of your own about manned versus unmanned space, or even just a suggestion for a topic that we should cover in the future, get in touch with us. Let us know what you're thinking. You can email us. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com, or just go to fwthinking.com. Check out the videos there, the blog posts, the podcasts. We have links to some pretty incredible articles that can go into even further detail about things like space exploration and other topics as well. We want you to be part of the conversation. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.